British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is about to travel to Saudi Arabia to reportedly lobby Crown Prince MBS to raise his country's oil output as Western energy sanctions on Russia begin to bite. He's already quizzed about a murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, whose killing U.S. intelligence agencies found was ordered by MBS. Johnson has compared President Putin to a drug dealer who has managed to hook Western nations on Russian oil and gas supplies ahead of his trip to Saudi Arabia. He's urging other European states to get themselves off that addiction. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi, and these are our guests in this episode of The Spotlight. Director of the IGA, Ali Al-Ahmed, is joining us out of Washington, D.C. Also with us will be the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Chajere, in London. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now let me go to Ali. British Prime Minister Johnson is to visit Saudi Arabia, as you know, to demand more crude supplies. And, you know, Saudi Arabia has been waging this devastating war on Yemen for 7 years. It's turning to be 8 years soon. So why do you think Boris Johnson never goes to that kingdom to push them to stop the ruinous war on Yemen?
The UK and Boris Johnson and his many of his cabinet ministers, present and the former British leaders, are involved in the war. They benefit financially from this war. The United Kingdom actively supports the Saudi invasion of Yemen over the 7 years since it started in 2015 and before even. The British provide logistic, military, and direct assistance to the bombing and siege that the Saudi and the Emiratis are waging against Yemen. So you can see the contrast between what the same person is doing vis-a-vis the Russian interference in the Ukrainian civil war versus the Saudi invasion of Yemen. So that is the policy of the United Kingdom and its government for a long time, to encourage wars between Arabs and Muslims and to feed off these wars. And that is a principle in the doctrine of the ruling class in the United Kingdom.
Uh-huh. Okay, let me turn to London. Masoud, you know that Johnson will be landing in Saudi Arabia later today to meet with Crown Prince and de facto ruler there, MBS. And this is only 3 days after, you know, Saudi Arabia executed 81 people in one single day. And most of those people, who were they? They were political dissidents and pro-democracy protesters. So what message would this trip send to the Saudi rulers?
Well, it really is a very devastating message. I mean, the message is very clearly saying that you could continue your tyranny, you could continue killing your own people, you could continue killing people like Khashoggi, and you could sort of unleash war crimes against Yemenis day in, day out, targeting innocent people. But the business is as usual. We wrote a letter to Boris Johnson today highlighting exactly all these points. The fact that, there's no doubt and the way that the kingdom in Saudi Arabia, this regime, is undermining every aspect of human rights and promoting tyranny, even in the royal family. I mean, he doesn't even stop on his own family. We know what they did. And I think, what is really important is not just for the money. I mean, the reality is that when you look at the sort of the export from Britain to Saudi Arabia, including all the weapons that is being given to him to kill innocent people in Yemen, when you look at that, that's not even 1% of GDP. So really, we are talking about peanuts in comparison to the economy of Britain. This has been done not because it's benefiting ordinary people in Britain. This is benefiting the sort of elite in Britain. Arm industry doesn't really bring a lot of employment or benefit to masses. It only fills the pocket of those rich individuals, those 1% of the society. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, this is happening for their benefit, although prime ministers and politicians in Britain claim that they are selling these arms, you know, to bring benefit to masses. But arms sales doesn't bring a benefit to masses, mm-hmm. and it actually creates this sort of environment that, you know, tyrants like the prince are actually going to go much further because there is no one stopping them, and there is no consequences for the murders of 81 people or murders of hundreds of thousands of people in Yemen, and indeed creating sort of havoc inside Saudi Arabia. Let us not forget, there are 30,000 political prisoners in Saudi Arabia, and mm-hmm. that is an astonishing number in comparison to the number of citizens in that country.
Okay. Master, if we have time, I'll come back and ask you about the highlights of your letter to Johnson. Okay, now let me ask Ali, what do you think that MBS will ask for in exchange for pumping more oil into the market?
American agreement with MBS is that they will bring him back to the international fold and to whitewash him and rehabilitate his image. And that part of it was Macron went and met with him, and now Johnson is meeting with him. And then the next will be the Americans directly, either the foreign minister, the secretary of state, and then Biden himself, or Vice President Kamala Harris, then Biden. So I think he still wants to be brought back, received, and of course he wants to have assurances that he will be the king, and with support, and the criticism in certain quarters will end. He does not even like it when a newspaper criticizes him. So you will see in the next few months the British government leaning on the BBC, on British media, to stop criticism of MBS. And the same thing has been requested from the Americans. Mm-hmm. Even an article in the Washington Post will make MBS upset, and he will want to pressure the Americans. So the MBS wants to give more oil, pump more oil, but he wants a price, and that price is giving him weapons, more weapons, so he can, you know, in his mind, combat Iran's power in the region.
Mm, and let him take out the dissidents. Okay, Masoud Shajara, we have Reprieve, a human rights advocacy group, accusing the British Prime Minister of, quote, trading oil for blood. Is Boris Johnson trading oil for blood, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I think it goes without saying. Johnson knows very well that appeasing a tyrant and sort of someone who's psychotic, like the prince, it really is very dangerous. This guy is unstoppable. He has got no sort of standards or limitation. And to appease him is basically unleashing him, not just against his own citizens and even his own family, but against the whole region. And, you know, let us remember what happened to Shah of Iran. Shah of Iran was, you know, similar personality to some extent, and he wanted to be supported to be the stooge of United States and the West in the region against the interests of his own citizens and his own people and his own region. And you saw what happened. And really, indeed, the same thing will happen. And people both in Saudi Arabia and the region are not going to tolerate a sort of a psychopath who actually kills people like that and destroys the lives of people in Yemen. And indeed, even as I said, goes for his own family. I think we need to sort of understand that this is a very dangerous to go and appease people like that. There will be no future. Nothing good will come out of it.
Now, Ali, what about the Khashoggi assassination case, for which Riyadh is responsible. What makes the UK close its eyes on such blatant crime and opt for a cozy relationship with the perpetrators?
The UK has never really cared about the Khashoggi case or another. I disagree with your oil. It's just part of the genetic ideology in the UK and the ruling class there, that they do not view their Muslims with, they don't see value their life. Even if it doesn't harm or their interests, they are not willing to do anything to stop murders or crimes. This has been the history of the British Empire and the British government. Those crimes, many of them, especially in Yemen, were not carried out. The Saudis were not able to carry them out without support and direct support and help from foreign government, including the UK government. So they are partners in this crime. That's why they are not going to even these crimes, because they are supporting them, even if they didn't state this support openly. They are indeed partners to these crimes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Master Shahzad, we've talked enough of the UK. Let's now turn to the U.S. and discuss that a little bit. President Biden had promised, if you remember, a hard line in Saudi Arabia. He pledged that the U.S. would finally teach dictators a lesson by punishing Saudi Arabia. Biden said at a 2019 Democrat debate, and I'm quoting him, that we are going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. These are the words of President Biden. So why did he fail to deliver on these promises and claims?
Unfortunately, the what it rules is pounds and dollars. And the fact of the matter is that the value of the lives of people in Yemen or in Saudi Arabia or the region has got, there's no value to it. So although they, from time to time, we hear this sort of sentiment that they want to be bringing some sort of ethical sort of dimension to their policy, but that is really just empty words. It's empty words in the United States, empty words in United Kingdom. I mean, United Kingdom, the courts actually ordered the government to stop sending arms, but they still do it. Same thing in the United States. They are breaking their own principles, their own ethics, and their own laws to just continue doing this. And this is why I'm saying that, there will be a price to pay for this, in the same way that there was a price, they had to pay a price vis-a-vis Shah of Iran. And when that happens, after that, people will not have short memory. They will realize that people like Saudi rulers, they have ruled and they have killed with the support of the United States and the support of the West, and they couldn't have caused this sort of mayhem and destruction without their support.
Right. Ali, we have also the U.S. State Department citing, let me cite what the U.S. State Department has said, significant rights issues, including unlawful killings. This is all about Saudi Arabia, based on that report. Executions of nonviolent offenses, forced disappearances, torture, and inhumane treatment of prisoners, all this by Saudi Arabia. And the list goes on and on. This is just a little part of this. So despite all this, we still have the U.S. treating Riyadh as a special and very close ally. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Yesterday, the spokesman for the State Department refused to even comment on the executions that happened on Saturday. And in addition, the American government continues to train Saudi military in the United States, in Nevada, and in Saudi Arabia, also in King Abdulaziz Air Base, which is near where most of the victims of the executions live. Mm-hmm. The person, the American official in charge of promoting human rights and democracy, yesterday praised one of the Saudi human rights criminals, Mohammed Al-Isa, who established the terrorism court that has sentenced hundreds of people to death, mostly protesters and activists. He is responsible for killing, torture, and abuse of women rights and other violations. Yesterday, the Mrs. Zia, she is the top American official for promotion of democracy and human rights, praised him with a picture in her account. You know, today she is testifying before the Senate on how to counter autocracy or authoritarianism in the world. This is the American policy. But to them, their friends are, no matter how horrible they do, no matter how horrific crimes they commit, they don't even bother to issue a statement, because again, this is really, it's cultural, it's the racist, that the value of 81 lives in their mind does not reach to the level of issuing a statement that does not do anything. It's just a statement. So even an empty statement from the State Department did not come out, and the spokesperson refused to say anything about them. And that is the real policy of the United States. Human rights was used as a weapon. They don't believe in human rights outside their borders. America has a lot of issues with human rights, but they do have some standards in this country. So, but they do not care about human rights when it comes to Arab and Muslim countries. Even if they stated, even if they condemned countries like Iran and Iraq and Syria and others, it is all used or is coming out of political expediency, not because they truly believe in the rights of Arabs and Muslims. And this is something the U.S. has to deal with, just like it had to deal one day with slavery and continues to deal with racism in this country. This is an issue that must be in the center and must be brought to the attention of the American elites, both in the political and intellectual side.
Okay. Now, Masoud, the West, spearheaded by the U.S., you know, has always boasted of observing human rights. They've kept criticizing others for not doing so. How come when it comes to their interests, they totally forget about such claims?
Human rights and articulation of the human right is just a tool. It's just a tool to sort of achieve goals, political goals. It's very clear now. I mean, you know, we have on one side the sort of Ukraine crisis, and you know, everyone is sort of attacking Russia and sort of highlighting how many tons of bombs have been dropped in the last few weeks. And then in the same time, we've got the same amount of bombs being dropped on Gaza just in a matter of one day. And, you know, the double standard, the hypocrisy of it, it actually highlights that human right is just a tool to be spent and to be used for a political purpose. And indeed, we have to understand the fact that these 81 poor souls had to perish and have to be executed right now in this particular time is because that the prince calculated that this is a good time to do it, because the West is under pressure for oil and everything else, and they are going to let me get away with it, get away with murder of innocent people. And this is a calculation that he's doing, and the calculation that the West is doing, that this is the price to pay. So human rights, it really is just an excuse, and it really is not a is not at play at all.
Okay, Ali, we have 1 minute for you for your final comments.
Yeah, look, this what happened here, it was ordered by MBS himself. No such executions could happen in the country without an order from the top, and that person who ordered it personally is Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi Crown Prince. So this crime falls number, he is the number one person responsible for it, and people who followed or carried on that crime also are responsible. This is an opportunity for the American and the Europeans to show us if they are honest about their claim that they support human rights. Let's see sanctions on these individuals. Let them make them the pariah that they are, as Biden once said. And he said it only just to get elected, and then after that, he changed his position to the people in our world. The brown skin people is like, this is the reality of Western policy. They use mm-hmm. human rights when it suits them, when it's good for them. But they defend the worst human right criminals you can imagine. Let us remember, Churchill is one of the most is a war criminal, massacre. Who carried massacres across the world, and yet you never hear that. So about in the West about these crimes, he's hailed as an example of democracy.
Right.
This is the same policy. The judges and proxies are called reformers while they are killing and starving millions of people.
Okay, thank you so much. That's all the time we have. Director of the IGA, Ali Al-Ahmed, joined us from Washington, D.C., and head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masroor Chajri, from London. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the necessary features of dining table. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the necessary features of dining table. One of the necessary features while we sit on the dining table and we are about to eat is to take the name of God before we eat something. To say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim before we eat something. And why it is important? It is important because it is said that when you're about to eat, take the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on it. Say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim so that it will have barakah. It will have the material and the spiritual effect. Obviously, the material effect is that it becomes the part of the body. And the spiritual effect is that this food will give me energy in order to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Obviously, I need some energy for my body to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And if it is a halal food, if it is said with the bismillah, obviously there are many effects, positive effects that are made on this food. And we know that sometimes the food have obviously harms in it. And it is said in the narrations as well that if someone says Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim before eating something, then the harms are, the food will not harm him and it will not impose or have any harm on him. Therefore, he will be saved. He will be safe from the harms of the food. So this is because that we have said Bismillah. And there will be a shifa, a cure in the food. So Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim has two positive effects. One, it will not harm you if the food has any harm. And the second thing is that it will have a cure if you need something to be cured. This food will provide the cure, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the necessary features of the dining table. And we said that one of the necessary features which is required on the dining table according to the Islamic lifestyle is to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim or Bismillah before you eat. Now, we said that it has a positive effect if a food has a harm. It saves us from that harm, and obviously it also have a cure. Now, we have a story from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that one of his companions, he came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and he said to him that, "Oh Imam, whenever I eat food, I feel sickness and it does not help me. So what should I do?" Imam said, "Why don't you read Bismillah before eating?" He replied that, "I do say Bismillah before eating." Then Imam went back to him and he said to him that, "Okay, if you say Bismillah, then why do you cut the effect of Bismillah by speaking in the middle of eating?" Now, here it say the narration says that when a person says Bismillah, it is from the ethics that when you're eating something, just have attention towards what you're eating and do not talk while eating. And therefore, if someone speaks or talks during what he is eating on the table, obviously we have this habit a lot to talk to each other, then the effect of Bismillah, it finishes. And then Imam said that you need to say Bismillah again if you speak in the middle of eating, if you talk to someone in the middle of eating, because the Bismillah which you have said before, you broke it by talking in the middle of eating. And obviously you need to say Bismillah again. So this teaches us two lessons. Number one is every time that when we sit on the table, we should say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim and eat and do not talk to anyone. And if you talk to someone, then say Bismillah again before start eating again. And on the other hand, it is necessary, it is from the ethics to be silent while you are eating and pay attention to what you are eating, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United Nations WFP has expressed concern about the situation of children in Afghanistan, announcing that acute malnutrition rates are high in 28 out of 34 provinces of the country. The UN body says 3.5 million Afghan children currently need nutrition treatment. The head of Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital believes this situation is due to cuts in global aid and mass poverty triggered by U.S. sanctions.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers can't afford enough nutrients at the time of pregnancy. When the mother herself suffers from undernutrition, the baby, of course, becomes malnourished. In addition to providing milk and nutrients, health bodies should also provide such families with some cash aid for a specific period of time so that the mother and children don't face malnourishment after recovering.
Some Afghan mothers also say they can provide their babies with needed nutrition, as their entire families are going without food to eat.
I'm a widow. I can't afford a packet of flour to cook bread. My family members are going without food to eat. There is no male breadwinner in our household. This daughter of mine is malnourished, and I'm afraid the other children also become undernourished if this situation continues.
The UNHCR says that at the Antalya Diplomacy Forum, everyone agreed that in spite of the extreme gravity of the Ukraine situation, other crises, including that of Afghanistan, must not be forgotten. Afghans are also calling on Western powers not to ignore the crisis they caused in Afghanistan.
Western powers caused the situation in our country. They imposed the war and control everything here. Today they are shifting all attention to the Ukraine crisis. That is important, but what about Afghans' plight? They shouldn't forget poor and suffering Afghans.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and major funding to the country was halted. The developments affected lives across the country.
The situation is still perilous in Afghanistan, where millions of lives depend on foreign aid. Afghan people are calling on world countries not to forget them and to continue their assistance to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Majlis-e-Wahdat Muslimin is holding this emergency press conference after the same past patterns of Shia targeted killings emerge in the country, where killers either going scot-free or sectarian hate mongers are allowed to spread venom against Shia Muslims.
Participants here say that the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has miserably failed to make needed structural changes against hate mongering to root out this threat from the society.
After the recent carnage in Peshawar Mosque, Shia-targeted killings gained momentum in the port city of Karachi, where leaders of Shia communities Pasmane Azhar Salman Haider was gunned down before his house, signaling another wave of Shia-targeted killing following the same decades-old patterns.
This press conference is about the start of new wave of targeted killings in Pakistan and the overall declining security situation in the country, which is evident that Khan administration at center has changed its priorities and cannot deliver on its promises. First in Quetta, then in Peshawar, and now targeted killing in Karachi. If enemy states are doing this, then where are our security institutions whose job is to safeguard Pakistani lives?
Imran Khan's government made promises to all Pakistanis to go against foreign-funded hate mongers and will implement National Action Plan in its full spirit to eradicate these sectarian elements from the country. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, this government has done no implementation of the National Action Plan, and as a result, came this new wave of Shia-targeted killings across the country.
Shia Muslims have seen carnages in Pakistan over the last three decades. They believe it is the direct consequence of the Takfiri ideology promoted in Pakistan by certain regional states. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
With the Persian New Year, or Nowruz, being just around the corner in Iran, people are getting prepared to welcome the arrival of spring. This comes as the sixth wave of coronavirus in Iran appears to have been subsiding now. The official daily number of fatalities, which had stood at 241 on February 27th, fell to below 120 over the past couple of days. The Persian New Year, or Nowruz, arrives on March 21st. The Nowruz holidays are traditionally a time when Iranians travel and visit each other. But health officials are worried that the exchange of visits and travels during the Persian New Year will lead to a new wave of COVID-19 if health protocols are not fully observed.
In view of this special feature of the Omicron variant, we highly request people to keep wearing masks and observe social distancing. Although many of them have been vaccinated, wearing a mask is still an important measure, especially when they are visiting relatives and friends during Nowruz.
I think everyone should receive the third dose of vaccine. And if you want to be safe, we should postpone our visiting and travels to some other time. If we don't take Omicron seriously, the next wave will sweep across the country again.
I have recovered from coronavirus almost 20 days now, but too much coughing hurts me a lot, and symptoms are still with me and my daughter. It's a bad disease, and people should not forget to observe the health protocols.
According to official statistics, over 56 million Iranians have received the second jabs of vaccines, while over 24 million others have been vaccinated with the third shot.
Under the travel rules released for Iran's third Nowruz with COVID-19, only those who have received at least two doses of vaccines are allowed to travel by their private cars across the country during the Persian New Year holidays. Otherwise, they will be fined. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip attended a big ceremony to mark the 54th anniversary of the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to the tens of thousands of Palestinians who got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffered from permanent disabilities during Israeli wars. Israeli forces have also injured some 30,000 peaceful Palestinian protesters who were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies. Hamas movement, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of committing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The amount, the volume, the size of the injury indicated that we are facing a criminal side, which is occupation. I think it is very important indication about the type and the impact of the Israeli actions, Israeli crimes against the Palestinian.
During the Israeli war in May of 2021, over 2,200 Palestinians were injured, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation.
We have to stress the role of the wounded in Palestine and their great role. They are Palestinian, you know, wounded are in the first line with the occupation. So they sacrifice with their bodies in order to, free Palestine.
Palestinians say that Tel Aviv's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from Western countries. The Islamic Jihad movement accused the United States of encouraging Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people.
I think that who give the Israeli the green lights, Americans, the United States of America, and the silence of people, which silence all over the massacre which carried by the Israelis against our people, and also maybe the Arab position, so that the Israelis go on to hit, to destroy, to kill, to injure everything against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for wounded Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip since 2008, amid what observers describe as an international conspiracy of silence. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
South Korea elected a new president Wednesday as conservative People Power Party candidate Yoon Suk-yeol defeated progressive Lee Jae-myung by less than 1% after all the votes were tallied. Yoon was quick to outline the hard line he will take with North Korea.
In order to protect the safety of our people, property, territory, and sovereignty, we will build a strong military capacity that can reliably suppress any provocation. I'll firmly deal with illicit, unreasonable behavior by North Korea in a principled manner, though I'll always leave the door for South-North talks open.
North Korea conducted several missile tests in the weeks leading up to the election. Some analysts believe President-elect Yoon, a former prosecutor entering politics for the first time, will face some early challenges from Pyongyang.
The Conservative Party has been very critical of the government's position on military exercises. Of course, South Korea will come out with a new North Korea policy, but North Korea will also conduct a couple of activities to test the Yoon administration. I'm not sure whether this will lead to conflict or dialogue.
The Moon Jae-in administration had sought engagement with North Korea, but its policies were often stymied by a hardline U.S. approach. Yoon Suk-yeol's foreign policy marks a stark turnaround from outgoing President Moon Jae-in, particularly concerning North Korea. Yoon advocates the deployment of a second U.S. anti-ballistic missile battery to protect the capital, Seoul, the resumption of joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises, and the preparation for South Korea's military to execute a preemptive strike on North Korea should Pyongyang pose an imminent threat. In addition to the difficult North Korea issue, President-elect Yoon will have to deal with a raft of domestic problems, including a housing price bubble and income gap, a surge in COVID-19, as well as rising inflation. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Cult in Heart of the Republic is the title of a book written by a member of the French Senate, Nathalie Goulet. In her book, she shines a light into the formidable anti-Iran terror group known as Mujahideen-e Khalq Organization, or simply the MKO. The author tries to warn her fellow Senate members that a full-scale terror group exists in the heart of the French Republic. Here, in Iran's city of Qom, political thinkers and activists have gathered to unveil the first Persian translation of the French book.
In the book, A Cult in Heart of the Republic, Mrs. Goulet writes about the grisly crimes against humanity perpetrated by the MKO and how they crushed all humanitarian principles to ascend to power in Iran. The author warns the French parliament that the formidable group now enjoys full financial support from Paris and is infiltrating into the French government.
The group also fought alongside Iraqi forces against Iran during the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s.
During the early days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the group tried to take power in Iran. But when they failed because of lack of popularity, they tried to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic. The MKO brainwashes its members and does not allow them to get married and form a family. They are like a war machine which are designed to kill.
In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. The terror group was then relocated from an American military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Since then, the U.S. and Europe have been taking part in the MKO's annual summits in Paris. Nathalie Goulet's book tries to highlight the criminal track record of the MKO, while warning France that it's making a big mistake by supporting the terror group.
France is a country that claims to care about money laundering on the global stage. But based on Nathalie Goulet's book, the French government is conducting large-scale money laundering to fund the MKO terrorists. The U.S. also lends its political support to the terror group. This is both double standards and folly, because the MKO's functionality has long expired.
The MKO is currently led by 68-year-old Maryam Rajavi, who is facing pressure from French human rights entities as, quote, a smear on France's record of human rights advocacy.
Aside from warning France of the security threats posed to her country by the MKO, the French author says capitalizing on the terror group is nothing but a waste of time and money. She argues that the MKO is viewed as an obsolete killing machine in the minds of Iranians and has no place in Iran's sociopolitical structure. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Massive explosions lit up the night sky over Erbil, the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, in the early hours of Sunday. Initial reports pointed to the detonation of as many as 12 ballistic missiles. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles, targeting a strategic Israeli center for conspiracy and villainy. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital, Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting a furore. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. Some analysts believe Israel is pursuing several objectives in the Iraqi region.
Of course, they can also foment sectarianism in places like Iraq, you know, picking on individual weaknesses of people with the finances of the Americans or others. They can create, all sorts of divisions and hatred to create problems within these nations. And their primary purpose is really to encircle the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the only nation and the most powerful nation that stands up for the oppressed in that region. And the primary oppressor in that region, of course, is Israel.
The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. Words that will now sound even more reassuring to the nation and forbidding to its enemies.
In Paris, demonstrators gathered to warn that while the world is distracted by the conflict in Ukraine, pro-Zionists are stepping up their violence and oppression against Palestinians worldwide.
A steady trend of murders. I mean, 2-3 teenagers assassinated per week. Hundreds, if not thousands, of olive trees uprooted. Houses demolished, night arrests. It's going on continuously.
At the major pre-election dinner held by France's top Jewish lobby, known by the acronym CREEF, France's prime minister announced the banning of two pro-Palestinian groups. The administration of President Emmanuel Macron has falsely declared anti-Zionism to be the same as anti-Semitism, and has already closed many of the nation's top Muslim and anti-racist organizations. Many around the world have been shocked at the swiftness with which the West is sanctioning Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, noting that nothing similar was even remotely attempted to help Yemen, Palestine, and so many other non-white conflict areas. Unlike Ukrainian refugees to the European Union, Palestinian refugees aren't being awarded visa papers, the right to work, medical care, rights to housing, and other social services.
In France, the government, almost all the media, all the political parties immediately stand for Ukraine. In a way, they launch in a minute a practical BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Russia.
Western mainstream media and social media are openly encouraging armed resistance by Ukrainians against Russia, and yet resistance fighters in Palestine and other Muslim countries are called terrorists and subject to intense propaganda and censorship.
The double standards and Russophobia currently sweeping the West aren't just discrediting the West, they're providing a cover for far-right violence, oppression, and censorship. Many note that those aren't new policies for the West, and nowhere more so than in Palestine. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
I
as the vicious war in Ukraine rages on, refugees struggle to find somewhere, anywhere, safe to stay. The dominant media narratives are heavily focused on Russians and Ukrainians fighting each other. But here in Poland, Press TV found a unique exception. Meet Svetlana, a Ukrainian mother who fled Kyiv with her two children, Dmytro and Ksenia. They have been taken in by a native Russian who lives in Lublin with his Polish wife.
For me, it wasn't even choice. I just started to write to my friends in the messengers and suggest them help or hosting. And I think it's the only choice I had. I feel angry that I can't stop it, I can't help.
Svetlana was forced to flee as the fighting surrounded the city. Her family have endured a 630-kilometre journey through the freezing cold. She tells us the ordeal has been traumatising.
After the war started, it was a great fear that hit us. The first thing I did was turn on the news. Then I collected just three suitcases and suddenly we had to run. We didn't know what to pack, what to eat, what medicine to bring, how will we cook, and what about school. To be honest, to be less stressed, I just turned off my feelings. If I had time to think about all the danger, I'd probably go crazy. The journey we had to deal with and the uncertainty. It was physically very hard, and I was only allowed to relax and cry once we escaped.
Poland has become a beacon of sanctuary for many refugees, with some 1.5 million already entered the country and many more on the way.
Unfortunately, the refugee crisis has now become heavily politicised, specifically in the English-speaking world. But behind those headlines are just ordinary people trying to get by. Regardless of whether they speak Russian, Ukrainian or Polish, the civilians all ultimately want the same thing, regardless of where they come from. An end to the war. Robert Carter, Lublin.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., new details from evidence cited in the indictment of Enrique Tarrio, the former head of the far-right Proud Boys, reveal a plan with similarities to what unfolded at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, "Document in January 6th Case Shows Plan to Storm Government Buildings." A document found by federal prosecutors in the possession of a far-right leader in the United States contained a detailed plan to survey and storm government buildings around the Capitol on 6th of January last year, people familiar with the document said on Monday, 14th of March. The document, titled 1776 Returns, was cited by prosecutors last week in charging the far-right leader Enrique Tarrio, the former head of the Proud Boys extremist group, with conspiracy. The indictment of Enrique Tarrio described the document in general terms, but the people familiar with it added substantial new details about the scope and complexity of the plan it set out for directing an effort to occupy six House and Senate office buildings and the Supreme Court last 6th of January. The document does not specifically mention an attack on the Capitol building itself, but in targeting high-profile government buildings in the immediate area and in the detailed timeline it set out, the plan closely resembles what actually unfolded when the Capitol was stormed by a pro-Trump mob intent on disrupting congressional certification of President Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. Many questions remain about the document, including who wrote it and how it made its way to Enrique Tarrio, according to prosecutors, on 30th of December 2020, as President Donald J. Trump was engaged in a series of overlapping schemes to keep himself in power. The people familiar with the document said other evidence the government has gathered suggests that it may have been provided to Enrique Tarrio by one of his girlfriends at the time. Prosecutors have not accused Mr. Tarrio of using the document to guide the actions of the Proud Boys extremist group who played a central role in the Capitol attack. Nor do the charges against him offer any evidence that he shared the document with his five co-defendants: Ethan Nordine, Joseph Biggs, Zachary Rail, Charles Donahue, and Dominic Pozzola. But the document could help explain why prosecutors chose to charge Mr. Tarrio with conspiracy, even though he was not at the Capitol during the attack on 6th of January 2021. And it appears to be the first time that prosecutors have sought to use evidence of a specific written plan to storm and occupy government buildings in their wide-ranging investigation into the attack and what led up to it. Enrique Tarrio's lawyer, Nayab Hassan, declined to comment. Broken into five parts: infiltrate, execution, distract, occupy, and sit-in, the nine-page document recommends recruiting at least 50 people to enter each of the seven government buildings and advises protesters to appear unsuspecting and to not look tactical, the people familiar with the document have said. After ensuring that crowds at the buildings are full and ready to go, the document suggests that leads and seconds should enter and open doors for others to go in, causing trouble to distract security guards if necessary. Should the crowds fail to gain entrance to the buildings quickly, the document suggests pulling fire alarms at nearby stores, hotels, and museums to further distract security guards or the police, the people have said. It then says protesters should occupy the buildings and conduct sit-ins, even recommending slogans for people to chant like "We the People" and "No Trump, No America." The document also makes suggestions for the days leading up to the 6th of January 2021, the people have said, advising protesters to scope out road closures near the seven target buildings. On the morning of the protest, they added, the document suggests having scouts drive around the buildings to look for roadblocks. While much of the document is marked for internal use, the people said it contains a section known as the Patriot Plan that appears to have been meant for public distribution. This part of the document suggests that crowds begin to gather at the seven buildings at 1 p.m. on 6th of January 2021, the people familiar with the document have said. 30 minutes later, the public part of the plan calls for the crowds to await a signal from lead and then to storm the buildings. The indictment of Enrique Tarrio, who recently stepped down as chairman of the Proud Boys extremist group, was a significant development in the Justice Department's sprawling investigation of the Capitol attack, and the second time in recent months that charges had been brought against a leader of an extremist group that played a prominent role in the assault on 6th of January. In January, prosecutors indicted Stuart Rhodes, the leader of the Oath Keepers militia, with seditious conspiracy for what the government has described as a plot to violently disrupt the work of Congress. Altogether, more than 30 Proud Boys have been charged so far in connection with the Capitol attack, and many more took part in it, but have not been charged. Members of the